Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect. This is All Sides with Amy Jervich. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy today. The Trump White House is no stranger to scandal, but often these scandals seem to fall by the wayside as new ones enter the news cycle. However, one such story refuses to die, despite the best efforts of the president and his supporters. Of course, we are talking about the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. He is the convicted sex offender who was facing federal sex trafficking charges when he died by suicide a couple of years ago. The files surrounding this case, Jeffrey Epstein, which President Trump promised to release when he was campaigning for president, have now become one of the biggest thorns in the president's side. President Trump has been trying to get people to move on from the Epstein story, and he had this to say from the Oval Office.
It's all been a big hoax. It's perpetrated by the Democrats, and some stupid Republicans and foolish Republicans fall into the net, and so they try and do the Democrats' work. The Democrats are good for nothing other than these hoaxes. They're bad for policy. They're bad for picking candidates that can get elected. I call it the Epstein hoax. Takes a lot of time and effort. Instead of talking about the great achievements we've had.
The Epstein hoax, that's what President Trump calls it, but it's looking more and more like it's not going to fade away. Joining us to get his take on all this and get an update of what's going on in Washington, D.C., we turn to All Sides favorite Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Ken, good to talk to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Let me ask you this. When this story first started to bubble up a couple of weeks ago, I thought, okay, this is a D.C. thing. It's a big story there. All the, you know, Politico and the New York Times and the Washington Post, they're all over this. The cable nets are over this. But does the rest of the country care about it? Now I think this has some legs. What do you think?
Oh, I agree completely. And I never thought of it as only a D.C. Beltway fixation. I mean, the fact is that MAGA from the beginning has been talking about it because they thought that, well, it's Bill Clinton, it's the Democrats, let's release the files. And Pam Bondi, I mean, the Trump administration didn't do itself any favors when Pam Bondi said, okay, we're going to release everything. And then Donald Trump said, yes, we're going to release everything. And then suddenly they're not going to release everything. And MAGA said, whoa, wait a second. I mean, this is not what we agreed on. We want to know the facts. We want to know who the pedophiles are. I mean, the pedophile argument has been going on for years, even before before Donald Trump was president. They were going after Hillary Clinton and that pizza thing in Washington where pedophiles were congregating, so-called, allegedly. And that was an obsession for the MAGA right for the longest time. So it's not going away.
Well, we're starting to get little nuggets as to what was going on during this time between when Pam Bondi, the attorney general, agreed or saying she was going to release the files, and then the sudden reversal saying, sorry, it's all over, nothing to see here. The Wall Street Journal yesterday reported that Attorney General Pam Bondi briefed Donald Trump in May that his name appears multiple times in the Epstein files. Now, we don't know what that means. Could just mean he had coffee several times. But again, another nugget that shows that inside the White House, there was some concern if this report is true.
Well, I don't think coffee is what they were discussing. And if you buy the Wall Street Journal's reprinting of a birthday card for Epstein's 50th birthday that Donald Trump apparently wrote and illustrated, of course, he doesn't do doodles, but we'll see about that. But anyway, that and Donald Trump is suing the Wall Street Journal for like $10 billion because he denied it being true. But the fact is that, look, yes, of course his name is in the files, and I'm sure Bill Clinton's name is in the files, and I'm sure Mike Thompson, no, I'll give you a breakdown there. But my point is that you're absolutely right. Just being in the files does not indicate any, you know, bad behavior. But given the videos we've seen of Trump, given the fact that Donald Trump was on the Howard Stern show saying that he and Epstein, like young girls, they hang out with beautiful women and maybe young girls and things like that. There's no question that there's more there that I would imagine Donald Trump would not like to see released.
First, to the reporting, this is not the failing New York Times reporting this stuff. This is Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal leading the story on
the
this.
The failing Wall Street Journal.
Now it is, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well,
what does that say to you?
Everybody's failing. If you attack Trump, you're failing. If you're a TV network, if you're CNN, you're failing. You're failing. You're failing. The failing New York Times, the failing CNN. And the fact that Rupert Murdoch, who basically helped create Donald Trump, leading up to 2016 when he was first elected, going after him. But it makes sense because he lashes out. If you look at him, look, Elon Musk was his best friend until he no longer was. So to see Donald Trump turn on the Wall Street Journal while seemingly astonishing doesn't is basically in part of his character that, if he doesn't like the way things are, and it's somebody else's fault, he'll gladly go after them.
And don't forget, it was Elon Musk who kind of started this again. You kind of breathed new life into this story when they were having their falling out, their nasty falling out there a month or so ago, said that the reason why they haven't released the files is because Trump's name is in them.
Yeah,
Well,
that ate Trump alive, and he's not forgiving him for that, clearly.
And that was the first, small little spark in the renewal of this story. But it's not just the media that wants these files, not just the MAGA Republicans who want the files. Members of Congress are now starting to call for investigations or subpoenaing Ghislaine Maxwell, the confidant of Jeffrey Epstein, who is serving time in prison for sex trafficking. Are you surprised that Republicans, especially in Congress, are not letting this slide?
Well, no, a lot of these Republicans are in moderate, maybe liberal leaning, well, not liberal leaning, but a lot of the Republicans are in competitive districts where folks back home are saying, look, get to the truth. So apparently there were at least 11 or 12 House Republicans. And of course, if they join with the Democrats to vote on an inquiry, that would be a majority of the House. So that's not a surprise that Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, said, "Okay, I've had enough of this. I'm going to
Go
end
home."
this session. We're going home, a week early, and we're not going to come back till September." Obviously, the hope is that this story disappears. But if we, given the fact that there was tremendous interest about, and again, it's not just a Washington obsession; it's around the country saying what's going on here. But my gut tells me, like with everything, that Donald Trump is not going to pay for this. He's not going to pay for it politically. Somehow, I'm just looking at his record. If you think of all the things he's done, and we don't have time on your show to say, talk about all the things that normally would have ended anybody's career. But given all the things, somehow, there'll be a Hillary story or a Barack Obama story. I saw that Tulsi Gabbard, the director of National Intelligence, intelligence, trying to come up with this concoction that Donald Barack Obama was part of a treasonous plot to subvert, overthrow the government. Donald Trump said from the beginning that this would be a campaign of retribution, and obviously going after Hillary and Biden and Obama is part of his plan. But it's failing because it's clear that what's going on now is all these diversions are not taking the public's away from this story.
Why do you think that is, Ken? I mean, it's still early. We're still it's July, it's late July, but it's still the heat of the summer. A lot of folks, except like us, are not paying very close attention. Why do you think this one might stick a little longer?
This is different. This is, I mean, look, abusing children, to me, that has to be the lowest of the lowest of the low. I mean, that's just a crime that is just despicable, and I don't think it's a Democratic Republican issue. So I think when given what Epstein is accused of, or had been accused of, or what he was going to face on trial until his death, and of course the argument now, people are wondering who killed Epstein in his jail cell. I mean, nobody knows, and so there's a lot of. It's not morbid curiosity. It's just, I think, revulsion of what the charges are. And some people say that even if it's Donald Trump, he shouldn't get a pass on something so horrific if indeed he is part of this Maxwell Epstein triage.
You know, Democrats have kind of stayed away from this scandal a little bit because there are Democrats who are connected to Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Clinton being the highest profile Democrat. Bill Gates has been connected to Jeffrey Epstein. Many people are here in Columbus. Les Wexner has been very much connected to Jeffrey Epstein. They were basically partners and business partners in some sense for many years. But he's not a Democrat, of course. Les Wexner is not. But Democrats now are embracing this and they want more answers. Could they regret that down the road?
No, not at all. I've never heard a Democrat say, well, let's protect Bill Clinton from this, or let's protect the Democrat from this. Almost every Democrat I've heard quoted saying, let the chips fall where they may. Whoever is responsible, whoever is involved in this despicable alleged crime should pay the price. And if it's Democrats who go down, we're for that as long as the truth comes out, whereas the Republicans seem to be more interested in protecting Trump and protecting the truth from coming out. So I think there's a big difference, and I'm not saying this because I'm favoring the Democrats in this, but Democrats seem to say, look, it's a disgrace there, and let's get the truth out. Republicans are less so willing to let everything come out.
So where does this go from here? The Justice Department is expected to interview Ghislaine Maxwell, I think next week is what I read this morning. Will we see the results of that interview from the Justice Department?
Not being a conspiracy theorist, I'm really not, but I'm nervous about this. I hope it's not a one-on-one with Pam Bondi. I mean, what if it's like, no, I'm not gonna even bother suggesting possible scenarios, but I would like it to be recorded. I would like other people to be there, and I would like it, a transcript of that to come out if possible, other than the usual redactions, because it's very interesting. She obviously knows more. You know, it's interesting. Pam Bondi for a while was saying, there's nothing there. There's no list. There's no client list. Well, why is Maxwell in prison for 20 years? There's nothing here. So obviously she knows a lot of the secrets. She knows where the bodies are buried. And I kind of think that meeting with Bondi and the Justice Department is crucial and should be above board and without hidden agenda.
Do you think Ghislaine Maxwell will testify before a congressional committee? Democrats are talking about subpoenaing her.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
that would be incredible if that were to happen.
It would be incredible, and once again take away from your opening question saying, is this just a Washington fascination? This would be, you know, Watergate, or even more than Watergate, because Watergate was still, I think, even Watergate, you know, when Sam Ervin launched his hearings in 1973, most of the American public were slow to get involved and, you know, pay attention. And ultimately they did. But I kind of think this is the kind of thing that would draw huge ratings from day one.
We're talking with Ken Reardon, the political junkie, host of the Political Junkie podcast here on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Jeffrey Epstein scandal and how it has come back in full force to sort of hamper the Trump agenda. Is that the biggest danger for the Trump presidency right now? Is this is dominating the news in D.C. Congress is on recess. They've just passed. We'll talk about it in a moment. They've passed two pieces of legislation that were big victories for the president. But going forward, this does threaten his agenda.
It does, only because the president has gotten everything he's wanted. He got the big, beautiful bill. He got the cuts in public radio and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He got the funding cut for that. He got the border, illegal crossings over the border, probably the lowest in history. He's gotten he's gotten his tariffs that he's demanding. And some of them are just outrageous, like with Brazil, which is beyond belief. But I mean, some of the things that he's wanted, he's gotten. Now there are still other countries who are still stewing over the kind of demands that Trump is making to get a deal. But I don't even think that Trump has any kind of a coherent vision about what he wants to do with the world economy. I think he just likes the thought, you know, the famous art of the deal. He likes making deals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's driving him a lot of these things. And they're not all working perfectly for him. But again, he's gotten a lot of what he wants. He still wants much more, but not if every question that goes to him is about Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, it's amazing that Well, he is really pulling out all the stops, trying to get us to talk about something else, including changing the name of the Washington Commanders back to Redskins.
Yeah. I'm not going to allow funding or approval of a new stadium unless it goes back to the Redskins. What message is he sending other than to a racist base who's just, you know, they hate the fact that it's no longer the Cleveland Indians or the Washington Redskins?
Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. He's our guest here as we talk about D.C. politics on All Sides. We'll return. We'll talk about the big bill. Democrats call it ugly. Republicans call it beautiful. That'll be our topic when we return here on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
This is All Sides with Amy Jervich. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy today. We are talking national politics with political junkie Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. The president's tax cut and spending cut bill was passed and signed into law on July 4th. It's been a few weeks now. Long battle to get this bill passed. It passed narrowly. It took a tie-breaking vote from J.D. Vance on the Senate floor to get it through. It extends the tax cuts that President Trump won in his first term, and it also increases military spending on border security and immigration control to pay for those things. It adds work requirements to Medicaid, which will lead to lower Medicaid benefits for many folks, also cuts food stamp, otherwise known as SNAP benefits for many folks. Despite the cuts, the Congressional Budget Office says it will increase the deficit by at least $3 trillion. Some estimates have it as high as $6 trillion. Ken Rudin, the battle over the bill is over. Democrats call it the big ugly bill. The Republicans call it, the president calls it the big beautiful bill. Now the battle is not over passage, it's over messaging to voters. Will this be good? Will this be bad?
Well, I mean, I think I saw a poll that showed that 29% of the American people support the Big Beautiful Bill, because I think that's the official name, although Chuck Schumer, I think, gave a speech on the Senate floor saying, I've gotten them to change the name of it, as if that's the big accomplishment of the Democrats so far. And we could talk about that as well. But it's not a popular bill. It just throws out the window the Republican argument of being fiscal responsible. I mean, Republicans would always talk about whenever there was a tax cut suggested or spending increase suggested during a Democratic presidents, they always said, well, we need to have corresponding cuts in whatever to make up for the deficit. Now we're talking about $3 trillion, maybe $5 trillion in debt added to the debt, which is just remarkable. And the Democrats are hopeful that the Republicans will pay a price for it in the 2026 midterms. I mean, my prediction again, we're still 12-15 months away from it, but I still think the Democrats pick up the House. The Senate will be much more difficult because of the numbers. But it's interesting that Republicans who talked about the bill and how bad it was, the people like Josh Hawley and others who talked about, and Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who's retiring, how bad the bill is, how bad it is for Republican principles, and they go ahead and vote for it. And I kind of think that one of the Democrats' strongest weapons is using the Republicans' words and their arguments in commercials, saying, well, if the Republicans know that this is just an awful bill, then I think the American people should realize it as well. So it's going to be a tough sell, certainly, especially, again, of course, we're talking about a year to go before the midterms, but especially if the Epstein story continues and the Republicans' message gets blacked out.
Here's an example of how Republicans are touting this bill. Bernie Moreno, our freshman U.S. senator here, he's got a few years, got several years before he has to run again. But he says the big, beautiful bill means no tax on tips, overtime, or auto loans, an expanded child tax credit, and historic investment in America's future. No Medicaid benefit cuts and no $4 trillion tax hike. Historic, unquote. So there, that's how he is selling it.
Is anything of what he said true? I mean, no Medicaid cuts. I mean, no tax increases. No tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, that's just a ridiculous spin. And of course, Bernie Moreno is not the one that the Democrats are going to quote. I think it's very interesting those Republicans who are up for re-election in 2026 who are much more circumspect about what the bill really brings and where it really cuts. I think those are the Republicans I'd like to hear from and see. And a lot of them are saying, now after they voted for it, they say, "Gee, I didn't realize it would be this bad." And well, that's so many like Lisa Murkowski, who got special deals for Alaska so she would vote for it. And then she said, "Well, I think the Trump administration is reneging on so that."
One of those senators who has to run for re-election is our John Husted, who is finishing the term left by J.D. Vance. So he is on the ballot next November, and he basically is saying much of the same of what Bernie Moreno said. Because if it hadn't passed, taxes would have gone up because those tax cuts would have expired. But he's also pointing out that the bill includes $50 billion in aid to rural hospitals, which he says means $1.6 billion for the state of Ohio. Several CEOs from rural hospitals in Ohio issued statements praising Senators Husted and Moreno for helping rural hospitals. That's how they are trying to sell this, that the tax cuts remain and there is help for rural hospitals and we're not abandoning those folks down there.
Oh, and that's absolutely true. I think there are a lot of Republicans who may have been wavering, maybe may have been on the fence, got special assurances from the administration that we would look out for some of your personal interests, like aid to rural hospitals. So I'm not saying those things didn't happen, but for the most part, I mean, to see what kind of Medicaid cuts there'll be next year, what kind of food stamp cuts there'll be next year, to see how the rich get richer, it sounds like a Bernie Sanders speech, but I mean, it's true that the rich will get richer, and I'm not sure. It depends who sells it better, and I think that's a big part of it.
The key words you just said there, Ken, next year. These cuts don't take effect until 27, after the midterms. So people really won't face these work requirements. They don't face losing Medicaid benefits until after they have already voted or stayed home in November of 26.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it takes effect after the 2026 midterms. I think that was a very smart move politically by the Republicans.
So how do Democrats drive this home if they are going to use this issue, if it really hasn't had any tangible effect on voters yet?
That's a good question, and it's a good point. And I think that's the task that the Democrats are facing, that you may not know it yet, and you may not feel it in your pocketbook yet, but it's coming. The pain is coming. It's hard to convince voters that the pain is coming if they don't feel it yet. And that's the task that the Democrats have in front of them.
We're talking with Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast here on All Sides with Amy Jurevich. I am not Amy Jurevich. She is off today. I'm sitting in for her, in case you were wondering.
She's at a Coldplay concert.
Oh, my God. You know, Ken, let's be distracted for a moment. That story, okay. I saw online, as divided as this country is, it's the one story that has united us.
Well, first of all,
for folks who aren't familiar, been under a rock for the past 2 weeks, there was a CEO and a human resources officer at a Coldplay concert at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. They were being very affectionate. And they got caught on the kiss cam, and then they immediately tried to duck out of it. And the Coldplay singer said they're either very shy or they're having an affair. And it was the latter, apparently. Allegedly.
Well, and, some of the funniest things are memes. Like I've seen, pictures of the Philly fanatic with another, and they're caught on the cam or
That actually happened. That they played Coldplay during the Kiss Cam at the Phillies game, and they had the Philly fanatic, male and female, playing those roles. It was great.
Hysterical, hysterical. And I've seen Trump and Epstein. I've seen all the things. But the thing that really hits me the most, because I am a little bit addicted to social media, and so many people say that these people violated their oath of marriage, which of course they did. They sinned, and they talked about Jesus and all this stuff. And a lot of the people who are clear, and I've checked this, a lot of the people who are clear Trump supporters went ballistic over this. How dare they? They violated, they betrayed his wife, they betrayed their oath, they betrayed their marriage oath. And these are people who still support Donald Trump. So there's so much hypocrisy everywhere. I'm not in favor of exposing everybody who's in an illicit relationship, but it just seems to be that there's so much hypocrisy regarding that. But you're right. The whole country is fascinated by it.
The best headline, New York Post, had a picture of this couple, and it said Dumbotron.
Truth to that. Oh, but the look on their faces. Oh. Had they stood up there and didn't react, the camera would have gone away and the story would have been over.
Yeah. Anyway, we digress. Back to more important things.
As we should.
Back to more important things in Congress. The rescission bill, not for something completely different, as they used to say on Monty Python. The rescission bill passed last week. Means $9 billion in cuts to foreign aid. And $1 billion cut to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which, of course, means no more funding for PBS and NPR stations. We, of course, pay PBS and NPR for their programming, so it eventually will affect them. You're biased, Ken. You've worked in public radio much of your career. You're still a big supporter of public radio. What will be the long-term impact of this, do you think?
Well, it's not that I'm biased. I mean, look. You could be a Democrat or a Republican. I remember Ted Stevens, the longtime Republican from Alaska, who spent many times on the Senate floor saying how desperately the far-flung islands of Alaska need public radio and public broadcasting. So it's not a Democrat or Republican issue, unless you're somebody like, you know, in the Trump administration who just wants to cut everything they see as liberal. But look, as I said, I've written this on Facebook, that I don't think NPR is going to suffer. I don't think PBS is going to suffer. But let's go to stick with NPR. The people who will suffer are the state of the member stations who, like, even like if NPR gets 2% of its funding from the federal government, many stations get 15% or 50%. And I'm so afraid that many public radio stations will suffer, some very seriously, some fatally. And I think now, I mean, I know this is not a fundraising show right now, but if stations are even, if people are even thinking about giving to public radio, this is exactly the right time, because the cuts that are going to really, really hit home with these member stations, especially the ones less financially viable. And this is just, it's just terrible. I mean, I have a lot of feelings on this, and we're not going to spend an hour on this.
But no, we don't want to. But it affects us here at WOSU. It's roughly, yes, we lose about 13% of our budget, comes to about $2 million. We're hearing from donors, and they're being very supportive, and we will ask them in the next week or so to help us out some more. So we will continue to serve the Central Ohio community. It's going to be more difficult now. And what do you think? Do you think Congress puts it back in?
I know that people are always tired of fundraising. You know, this week we're doing fundraising, and I understand this, but the threat is real and the danger is real. And I wouldn't say this if it really wasn't as serious as it looks like it is to me. Sorry.
Do you think that, a new Congress puts money back in, or is it gone forever, do you think, for public broadcasting?
Well, you need a new Congress, and you need a new House, and you need a new Senate, and you need a new president. I mean, if the Democrats take Congress in 2026, which I doubt, but if they do, you still have Donald Trump in office. So, so I think nothing will change until 2028 at the earliest, and there's no guarantee anything will change.
Yeah, he does
assuming,
not. Yeah.
Assuming he permits elections in 2028.
Well, I'm sure that'll happen. Anyway, there have been presidents in the past. Donald Trump in his first term opposed funding, but the way the budget process works, he does not have a line item veto which they have here in Ohio. So there is a chance there that if
but
the Democratic
Congress... But I remember Newt Gingrich, when the Republicans took control of Congress in 1995 for the first time in 40 years, Gingrich talked the longest time about, we got to cut NPR, we got to cut PBS and all that. And they've done the Republicans have been saying that for years. This is the first time it's actually come to fruition.
Speaking of media, let's turn to commercial media and one of Donald Trump's chief critics, Stephen Colbert. It was announced at the end of one of his shows that CBS is canceling The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
You may have heard the news. Last week, we learned that The Late Show will be ending in May. And now, for the next 10 months, the gloves are off. I can finally... Yeah. I can finally speak unvarnished truth to power and say what I really think about Donald Trump, starting right now. I don't care for him. Doesn't seem to have, like, the skill set. Doesn't have the skill set to be president. You know, just not a good fit. That's all.
Stephen Colbert. Ken, the bottom line is this show is losing money. Tens of millions of dollars a year. Do you think this was purely a financial decision, as Stephen Colbert and CBS and Paramount say?
I don't buy it for a second. I mean, Colbert was only quoting CBS. I don't know if Colbert believes it's a financial decision. And I think very few people think it's really a financial decision. Of course, we also know that CBS gave $16 million to Donald Trump because Donald Trump sued them for the way they edited a 60 minutes interview with Kamala Harris. And rather than fight the president because Paramount wants to deal with Skydance, they didn't want to, you know, fight with him, so they gave in with $16 million. So I don't know. Look, they are losing. Yes, it is losing money. Colbert Show is the number one ratings in the at late night. It's been the number one since 2017 or 2015 when he became more and more political. I think 2017 it took number one over Jimmy Fallon, and it happened 2 days after. Stephen Colbert called the $16 million, he's called it a big, dirty bribe or something like that, a terrible bribe. So the fact that the announcement comes 2 days or 3 days after Colbert's attacking of Paramount and CBS, I think it's a little more than a coincidence. But yes, they are losing money. They're all losing money. And that's the nature of late night TV, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, live TV is just, I mean, the people watching television now via streaming devices is now more than the folks watching over the air or on cable.
Isn't that remarkable? Yes.
And, you know, let's face it, the young folks, young people younger than really 45 are not watching live TV anymore, except for maybe sports and perhaps some news on cable TV. But
yep,
that's the reality that we all face in the media business. But the other reality is that media is very corporate now. And they have to they have to answer to shareholders, and the folks who are running these media corporations have varied interest in their portfolio, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that Paramount wants to take a hit on 60 Minutes to save a larger part of their corporation.
Oh, that's absolutely true. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that Donald Trump from the beginning has done an all-out assault on the media. It's attacked CNN as fake news, and it's attacked all the networks as fake news. They sued ABC News because they didn't like the way that they didn't appreciate the way that George Stephanopoulos talked about Donald Trump's relationship with Jean Maxwell, and so he sued him for $15 million, and ABC caved rather than fight a suit. He's suing the Des Moines Register because the pollster of the Des Moines Register had a poll in 2024 that showed Kamala Harris winning in Iowa, and that was clearly wrong, and Trump sued them for an incomplete, incorrect poll. So there's no question that Trump is going after the media, especially the media he doesn't like. And that's what makes the Wall Street Journal lawsuit of $10 billion even more. But he likes to sue. And nobody sues Trump. Like for example, Trump basically said yesterday that Barack Obama is guilty of treason. I mean, shades of Joe McCarthy that nobody says that, certainly about a former president. And if that's not inviting a lawsuit, I don't know what is. But Trump says what he wants. But if anybody else says it, then a lawsuit it follows.
All right. We're talking politics, national politics with the political junkie Ken Rudin here on All Sides. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy Jervich. When we come back, we'll talk about our favorite topic here in Ohio, and that is redistricting. That's exciting. When we come back, it's important, though, when we come back here on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
We're talking national politics here on All Sides with Amy Jervich. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Amy Jervich. And we're joined by Ken Rudin, the political junkie and host of the Political Junkie podcast. Ken, speaking of deals, let's call it that. Let's call it a deal. Columbia University has come out that they have agreed to pay $200 million to the federal government to settle accusations of tolerating anti-Semitism on its campus. And they say they're doing this to protect $1.3 billion of annual funding they get from the federal government every year. You know, from a purely business standpoint, Ken, paying $200 million now to protect $1.3 billion a year sounds like a wise thing to do. What do you think?
Well, it's still a bribe. I mean, it's very interesting that Donald Trump, who hangs around with anti-Semites and is, you know, has a good strong support with I don't want to go into further. Let me just say that it almost seems like Donald Trump's fight against anti-Semitism is really not what it appears to be, because so many of his backers are of that. No, let me think before I'm talking, because this is a very emotional subject. Yeah. I mean, I don't believe that Donald Trump is a big fighter against anti-Semitism, but he's attacking again. He's not only does he attack media, and he attacks the organizations, law firms. He's attacking law firms, and now he's attacking colleges because they don't do enough to stop anti-Semitism. So, yeah, financially, look, it never pays for anybody to stand up to Donald Trump, because in the end, they usually lose, or they it costs them more than they bargained. So if they feel that spending $200 million is enough to save a $1.3 billion investment from the government, it's worth it. But again, it's not too dissimilar to me of the way that Donald Trump deals with countries, organizations, law firms, the media, and that is to get more money to him.
Now, the complaint that conservatives and some Jewish organizations have about Columbia and other schools, including Ohio State here, there's been complaints here that there were some incidents of clear anti-Semitism during some of these protests, and the schools kind of, you know, stood behind free speech and didn't crack down enough. Will this force schools to allow less protests, especially Columbia, which has a long history of being very much a sort of an activist campus?
Yeah, I think it will. I think, look, first of all, was there anti-Semitic activities and actions on campus? Absolutely. And I think may a lot of people use the war in Gaza as an excuse, because a lot of them some of the slogans I've seen about Israel predate what happened since the October 6th, October 7th incursion and atrocity from Hamas. But be that as it may, it's clearly, there's a strong Palestinian contingent on campus, and they are loud and they are and sometimes ugly. But again, in the name of free speech. But in answer to your question, yes, I think it will. I think a lot of campuses will tamp down protests. I think there'll be a lot of, I mean, exactly, Columbia, you know, all those old enough to remember Mark Rudd in 1968 when the SDS took over Columbia campus and shut it down because of the war in Vietnam. So that's a history, that country, that college has a, university has a history of protest, I think, but you're absolutely right. I think the protests will be watched and controlled more under the Trump administration. In other words, another victory for Donald Trump.
All right, back to electoral politics. You know, usually every 10 years, the nation does a census. And after they do the census, we see where some areas have grown, some areas have shrunk or not grown as fast. And then they carve up the congressional map again. It's called redistricting to make
sure
that,
depending on who's in charge.
Well, yes.
What party's in charge.
I'm talking about, this is the theoretical process.
Yeah, gotcha. You're right.
So the good news used to be, this only happened once every 10 years. We had to go through this. Not anymore. Here, it's going to happen apparently in Texas. President Trump wants Texas Republicans to redraw district lines to add GOP seats to help Republicans maintain Congress. President Trump says they could pick up maybe 5 seats in this. Now they're only 5 years into the normal 10-year process. Ohio has to redraw its congressional districts this year because of court orders and court rulings from a couple years ago. This process should end every 10 years, right, Ken? Why do we have to do this again?
Well, what's happening in Texas this week is not unprecedented. In 2003, Tom DeLay, who was a rising Republican in the House and was very influential in getting Republicans in control of the state legislature there, decided that he also wanted to have, you know, they felt that Texas Republicans were on this, on the upsurge, and they were doing well, and yet they only had like 14 of the 32 seats. So in 2003, he had a redistricting in the middle of the 10-year cycle, so it's not unprecedented. But Donald Trump, this is a clear, naked opportunity for the Republicans to just steal seats. Let's redraw them now. Donald Trump, look, they only have a small margin of advantage in the House. He thinks that'll give them 5 more seats, which could be very, very crucial. Now, Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, who's a strong, who loves to taunt Trump at every opportunity, says, well, maybe we'll do that in California too, because we have an overwhelming Democratic legislature and we're going to maybe redraw them too. Now, except the problem is there are laws in California, and God forbid the Democrats violate any laws. So the Democrats know that there's a commission that is responsible for drawing the lines, and not the governor. It's not up to the governor, and he may have his hands tied. But the Democrats are kind of flailing for a response.
But in Texas, there is some thought that if they do redraw the districts, that now currently safe, very safe Republican districts will become a little more competitive.
That's true.
And if I'm a Republican sitting in that seat that is very comfortable, very safe, I don't want to take a chance. So it's not going to be a slam dunk just because President Trump says we need 5 more seats in Texas.
That's absolutely true. If you're pulling Republican voters away from already Republican congressmen to create new Republican districts, you will weaken these Republican representatives. And clearly, there's some apprehension about those who may have won convincingly in 2024, maybe not so much in 2026. And if there's an anti-Trump feeling in the country for the midterm elections of 2026, that could also add to the Republicans' problems in Texas.
Ohio.
And they also have a primary that's splitting the Republican Party in two. John Cornyn, a very conservative Republican, is being challenged by a very right-wing lieutenant governor, Ken Paxton, and who Paxton is leading in the polls. It could give the Democrats hope that it could give them a Senate seat in Texas for the first time since Lloyd Benson in 1988. So a lot of the Republicans are a little nervous in Texas right now.
Although we've heard that many times since Lloyd Benson left.
Exactly.
This is
we're going to win, and we don't win.
This is the time that Texas turns blue, at least a little blue. It never seems to work out.
Every 2 years,
In Ohio, we are going to redraw our congressional maps. We have 4 Democratic Congress people now. There is the thought that they're going to try to, Marcy Kaptur, which is the Democrat up in the Toledo area, she's very popular, try to maybe monkey with her district to make it's a pretty competitive district now to monkey with that district to try to flip that seat to Republicans.
She's the longest serving woman in Congress in history, and the Republicans have tried in the past to weaken her district and weaken the lines. She is a clear target.
Yeah, but a lot of folks up there say it's going to be really tough because she does attract a lot of crossover votes and is very popular. But you can draw districts very creatively these days.
I'm old enough to remember that in 1982, it was Democrats who drew the lines in Ohio. It was Democrats who drew the lines in Illinois, and they gained. So, you know, this is not a Republican creation, but of course, Democrat control of legislatures was a long time ago.
Yeah, I lived in Massachusetts in the 90s, and some of those districts they drew then were very creative. One literally was a snake. It went from central Massachusetts all the way down to southeastern Massachusetts, two parts of the state that had very little in common, all to move out a congressman. Anyway, Ken Rudin joins us now. He's the host of the Political Junkie podcast. What's the lot of speculation here in Ohio, Ken? What's the word in Washington about what Sherrod Brown might do? Have you heard anything? What's the word down there inside the Beltway about what office, if any, he decides to go for?
Well, it's sad for the Democrats in Ohio that their bench doesn't seem to be that big, and everybody's waiting to see what Sherrod Brown does. My gut, and of course, we're talking about the seat, John Houston's seat, mm-hmm. That was won for Sherrod Brown, that's the seat that Sherrod Brown gave up. My gut tells me he doesn't run. He's been around a long time. Before he was in the Senate, he was in the House. He was the Attorney General or
Secretary of State here in Ohio, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's been a million years. Was it Amy Acton who's also running?
She is running. She's the only declared candidate for governor right now. There is talk that Sherrod Brown he's considering either not running, running for governor, or running for U.S. Senate.
Yeah, well, obviously all eyes are on him because basically he is the Democratic hope in Ohio. And, I mean, I didn't think he was going to lose in 2024 to Moreno, and he did. And I don't know. I don't know if he has it in him anymore.
Yeah, he's the biggest name the Democrats have.
The only name I could think of.
Yeah, Tim Ryan is out there, the former congressman who ran for U.S. Senate a few years ago.
Maybe Frank Lausche could run. He died many years ago.
Ken, that's before my time, and I've been here a quarter century.
Youngsters.
Speaking of Democratic candidates, I mean, you know, Zohran Mamdani in New York is caught fire nationally. He's energized Democrats. Are there fresh faces out there, not just in Ohio, but around the country, who we should keep an eye on?
Well, Mamdani is another story completely because, I mean, he is fascinating. Just quickly, he's a fascinating figure in New York. He won the Democratic primary, and everybody says, wow, he's pro-Palestinian. He's pro-Infada. They're making him out to be the next, Yasser Arafat. But, of course, the fact is that he ran against Andrew Cuomo, the former governor who resigned because of sexual allegations and ethic allegations. So it's just fascinating to watch there. I don't know if
and there were what translates. Eight other candidates in that race too. So it was
were others, but basically, and Eric Adams, who was so unpopular, the African American mayor of New York, is so unpopular that he's decided to run as an independent. And Cuomo may run as an independent too. So that race is not over. But there are young people. There are people we don't know about. You know, people don't talk about too much, like Westmore in Maryland and Chris Murphy in Connecticut, and Raphael Warnock in Georgia. There are a lot of Democrats. Look, it is too early to talk about 2028. But the more I think of what the Democrats did wrong in 2024, and a lot of it regarding whether Joe Biden should have stayed in the race or not dropped out earlier. I mean, there's still so many second thoughts and second opinions about what should have been done. The Democrats really need to get a message together. And people say it can't be only anti-Trump. And that's true because there's more that the American people are concerned
about.
And
that's what Mamdani was good at. He was very disciplined. His message was it costs too much to live in New York City. Affordability, cost of living, inflation, housing costs. He just kept hammering that. And yeah, he made a lot of promises, you know, free buses and help for rent and things like that. But that's the economic message that I think that discipline that Democrats might have to follow to carve into. They can't just be against Trump. They have to be for something.
perhaps, but the establishment, the banking establishment in New York City, the big money are deathly afraid of Mamdani, and we'll see if they are strong enough to stop him in November.
Has Cuomo is still considering running? Or is he definitely going to run as an independent?
He's talking about running as an independent, but just this week, another sexual harassment case was brought up again, and he has a lot of baggage in his background, and the fact that it's amazing the things that the voters of New York City have to weigh if they're going to stop Mamdani. Do you want somebody who resigned from governor of ethics? You want a mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, who was pardoned by the Trump Justice Department for his crimes? So there's a lot going on there.
And it's the generational thing. Sherrod Brown faces it. Andrew Cuomo faces it. The folks are in their 70s or close to 70. I think a lot of voters want fresh faces. Vivek Ramaswamy here in Ohio is that fresh face that is energizing a lot of Republicans.
Mamdani would be the youngest mayor in over 100 years. There are young people out there who are just tired of the old Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Joe Biden age. You know, not to be an ageist, but there's new blood out there that is just desperate to be heard.
That'll do it. Ken Rudin, thanks very much for joining us. Lots to talk about. I'm sure that the news will not slow down. Amy Jurvich will have you next.
Next Coldplay concert?
Yeah, no. I'll wear a mask next time I go to a concert. Even if I'm doing nothing wrong, I don't want to be on the Dumbotron. Thanks very much, Ken Rudin, for joining us here on All Sides.
Thank you, Mike.
That'll do it for All Sides with Amy Jurvich. I'm Mike Thompson. Have a good day on 89.7 NPR News.